Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this Tuesday night live broadcast coming to you live from Austin, Texas. Very excited about tonight's episode. We will be joined by Jordan Sather. He is one of the creators of Dark Alliance, the inside story of the Cosmic Con. This is a story that is near and dear to my heart. Our good friend Mike Turber and I did an episode on Corey Good and the whole kerfuffle with Gaia and him coming out with the deposition and lawsuits, things like that, when these things hit the fan about a year or so ago. And the reason why this is something near and dear to my heart is, as you know, listeners, I'm a man of faith, not necessarily like walk through the church kind of faith, but the idea that, you know, people believe in something, and people believe in something for a reason. And many, many, many people believe in something because of experiences that they have had in their life, such as myself. And the whole reason that I have these conversations is because I have had unexplainable things happen in my life. Now, when you're talking the world of belief, when you're talking the world of not only want of confirmation, but also that close point of, you know, disassociation from the truth, and want of not finding out the truth as well. That is where a lot of this comes into with Dark Alliance and what the situation with Corey Good was. We're going to be peeling that apart tonight with Jordan Sather in the first segment. In the second segment, we will be joined by Bertie Jaworski. We will be talking about her work in the world of transdimensional mapping and what that means in remote viewing, and what remote viewing can do for the world of UFO UAP study. So once again, this first segment is Dark Alliance. Our guest is Jordan Sather. He is a citizen journalist, film producer, and entrepreneur in the media and health space. He has amassed hundreds and thousands of subscribers and tens of millions of video views on his account since 2017, all while enduring endless censorship by big tech. His documentary, Above Majestic, which he co-produced, reached number one on the iTunes and Amazon charts in 2018. Welcome to the show, Jordan Sather. How are you doing this evening?
Doing great, Chris. Christopher Jordan, sweet name.
Thank you. Yeah, I like your name. now, once again, this is a topic that it's hard for a lot of people to handle. Because when Gaia first came around, things like Corey Good and stuff like that were really top of the plate. You know, it was content that was heavily pushed. Heavily put to the top, and David Wilcox was really synonymous with Corey Good and bringing Corey to the forefront of this topic. How did you guys begin this documentary, and how did you begin to uncover the seedy underbelly of all of this, Jordan?
Yeah, great question, and forgive me. These are things that happen 5, 6, 7 years ago, and I haven't talked about them too much aside from a few interviews I've done on this subject recently. So I'm going to do my best to go through the mental Rolodex and try to remember a lot of this stuff. But basically, I had began following David Wilcox's work in about 2011, and remember his Source Field Investigation book. I became hooked on his blog. I can't remember exactly where I found his work, but I was buying what he was selling at that point. You know, mass arrest just around the corner, big disclosure happening. I've got insiders, I've got alliance contacts, all this sort of stuff. And then he brought Corey Good out around late 2014,
yep,
early 2015 timeframe, right? And then they quickly went onto their Gaia show and exploded in the whole UFO disclosure movement. I began, you know, I was following the UFO subject for years, and I was also very interested in health and exposing big pharma lies and a little bit of an interest in politics as well. And I decided in January 2017 to start a YouTube channel, and I called that YouTube channel Destroying the Illusion, where I talked about a little bit of all those things, a little bit of politics, health, quite a bit about UFOs and black projects and my interest in that regard as well, hidden technologies. My channel grew pretty quick, and then it was about maybe 4 months in where Corey Good's business manager at the time, business partner Roger, contacted me and asked me to kind of get involved in their group. And I was invited out to Contact in the Desert in 2017. So that would have been June. That was the last one they still held it at, Joshua Tree. Did Gaia own Contact in the Desert at that time?
I don't believe so.
I think they bought it later. It might have been 2018 where Gaia got invested in Contact in the Desert. Anyway, I didn't speak at Contact that year. I just went out to visit, meet Corey and the whole team. And it was about a month after that where we started filming for Above Majestic. In the beginning, it didn't really start as a documentary. It was just, I went to the MUFON Symposium in July 2017, and that's where William Tompkins was there. And William Tompkins was towards the end of his life, so we knew we had to sit him down and get him on camera. So I conducted the last video interview William Tompkins ever did there, and we sat for an hour and a half, 2 hours talking. And then that interview kind of turned into, well, let's produce this into a documentary. So I spent basically the rest of 2017 and the first half of 2018 going on road trips and going to all these different conferences and events, just interviewing all sorts of people. You know, Mark McCandlish as well, the late, great Mark McCandlish. I got an interview with him. David Adair, Dane Wigington, Nassim Harmin, a ton of different people. Not all of those interviews made it into the film, but it was a lot of work that I had put into it, and it became Above Majestic that released October 2018. Then, of course, it got real weird after that. Let's just say that. I can continue, but I don't know if you have any lead questions you want to...
No, please continue.
Yeah, so Above Majestic came out October 2018. And it was around that time that a few other sort of business partners became involved with Corey and his whole Sphere Being Alliance company, Leon Isaac Kennedy being one of those. And Leon had a long background in radio, in broadcast, in Hollywood, in all of this. So he knew people, he knew how to set deals up. And at the time, Leon believed in Corey and David as well. So he came in thinking that, well, we could take this, we could make this big.
Yeah.
And Leon was handling disbursements of the royalties for Above Majestic. And I'll say, when Leon was handling the business aspect of things, everything went great. I got paid, everybody else got paid, no problem. But it was sometime around maybe April 2019 that I think there was this power play going on. Corey threw a hissy fit. Corey started claiming that Leon was embezzling money and Roger was embezzling money and they were committing felonies and all this sort of stuff. And that's kind of when things, again, it got even weirder. But from what I understand, Corey created his own bank account for the royalties to get paid into. And the distribution company, I think it was 1091, for some reason, they agreed to just put all the royalty monies into Corey's account he made. And, you know, then I got basically screwed out of a lot of money. Let's just say that. So,
yeah.
Haven't seen a penny since probably April 2019. So
And that was a production company. Like I know quite a few people that produce film and things like that on different levels. And that was one that popped up in the media distribution to beware of group on Facebook. And I remember when I saw that and then heard from about three or four people in your position that did not, like, they pulled their films because they weren't getting paid for other work that they'd put in and stuff like that. And once again, when Corey first hit the scene, like, he's from the Richardson area, like Dallas, Texas, you know, just up the road from me. And I remember when it started happening, it was one of those, like, this is a fascinating story. And once again, I have the conversations I have, Jordan, because of the wild, the literally unexplainable experiences I've had. So I get it. And I am prone to believe the experiencer until proven otherwise because of that. But yeah, there were things with Corey's story that as the years went on, it just did not seem to add up anymore.
Yeah. Stories changed. The claims changed. And, you know, we kind of got to be careful. If somebody claims something, you don't want to just throw it out because it might sound too grandiose by
Absolutely.
All means. But evidence is required, right? So, and when the evidence just doesn't stack up and the claims keep going and going and going and getting grander and grander, and yet no real solid, verifiable anything, then that becomes a problem. And so the whole documentary thing went down. That left a real bad taste in my mouth. And it was around the end of 2019 where I started getting fed up with both Corey and David. I loved Bubba Majestic. I still think there's a lot of great stuff in that documentary, but if I could redo it, I would redo it and just completely take Corey out of it and reduce David's bloviating parts to like 10% of what it is in that film.
Yeah.
But towards the end of 2019, early 2020, the things they were claiming on the internet, not just about their own alleged experiences, but there was actually one point in 2018 where I was invited to go meet two of David Wilcock's insiders. And I did, and I went out to the East Coast and met these two supposed Alliance insiders, and I gotta say, they did not seem any kind of like whatever alliance means, right? They didn't seem any kind of
no super soldier, so to speak.
Yeah. And what blew my mind is that, you know, a year later, there was an event where I was on a panel with David. I think this was at Contact in the Desert in 2019. That I did speak at. I was on a panel with David, and David was introducing the panel as, you know, "Oh, Jordan, we met these two Alliance insiders, right? Yeah." And
yeah,
I was bewildered because I had never spoken about this publicly, and I wasn't comfortable speaking about it publicly because I wasn't sold on the fact that these people were inside anything except maybe inside David's head. But so that was weird to me. And then just a bunch of things that David was claiming on social media, Corey was claiming on social media, things that not about their experiences, but about the world, that were just verifiably wrong.
Yeah.
I remember in early 2020, right when the whole COVID thing hit and everybody started doing live streams, that David did this live stream on his YouTube channel whereby he claimed WikiLeaks drops new files.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that was the exact name of the live stream. It's still on his YouTube channel. And lo and behold, WikiLeaks didn't drop any new files. It was just an index URL of all their old stuff they dropped. And it didn't take more than a couple minutes to figure that out. It was nothing new. Yet David proceeded to do a 2-hour long live stream claiming that WikiLeaks dumped all these new files, and then proceeded to sell his $333 course in this live stream based upon fake information with a fake headline. It was just bad. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's like the dumbest smart person I've ever encountered, or he's just doesn't care and is fine to scam with wrong information. But So there was that. There was the legal issues with Corey that I saw piling up more and more.
Yep.
And I'm scratching my head thinking to myself, you know, I remember at one point on Corey Good's website, he called himself the Enoch of our modern times.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm like, if you had some higher density extraterrestrials, why would this be the jackass that they try to anoint as their, you know,
yeah, the chosen one, as the conduit. This is the conduit. Like, here.
How many blunts have I rolled for this guy? And this dude is the messenger to humanity. Anyway, well, I finally scrubbed my eyes, but because I was young, I was 26 years old when I started working with these guys and began the documentary. And I think I was about, you know, 29 when I finally started to, you know, when I broke away from them.
I made
public statements on my social media accounts and all that. I'm just like, you know, I'm grateful for the times I had with them, but I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And, you know, it comes down to a few things. And this is just it. It's the idea of him saying that the blue avians are his intellectual property, because they were his meditation guides that he created. Okay, yeah. Cool. Like I got a big Gandalf wizard that I use as mine. So I get it. You know, like I do guided meditation in that kind of way. I go to my crystal palace that I built and all that kind of stuff. I have a specific path that I walk down, everything else. Now, and I have people on my show that actively have channeled things on my show, Jordan. The thing is, we say beforehand that this is channeled information. No, none of my guests are saying like, so this is what happened to me last night. So this is what happened to me for the last 30 years of my life, you know, and there's a far cry difference between and even when it comes to freedom of speech and what have you, there is a far cry difference between saying that and saying, you know, that what I'm about to tell you is channeled information, things like that, or saying that this happened to me. And then as people come to you and give you money and share their experience, you continue to tell them that this is fact and it happened to me.
Yeah, you know, the framing and the contextualization of information and of experiences is very important. And it's also important for us as consumers of information or hearing claims not to be blind believers. The blind belief, you know, you can entertain a thought without accepting it and believing it. Like, I'm going to listen to this person. I'm going to hear them out.
Yep.
And okay, their story sounds interesting, but doesn't mean I have to outright believe it or not believe it. Right.
Yeah.
You just hold it in the, okay, could be, maybe, I don't know, box. And I think our egos get very uncomfortable in that space of not knowing. So we polarize so fast to either accepting or not accepting when each of those could be, you know, the wrong path. So
yeah.
Anyway, when it comes to this whole alternative media space that so many people, millions of people, tens of millions are gravitating towards now, which is fantastic.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's great that we're breaking away our collective consciousness from the authorities and the establishment. But in this alternative social media space, it's basically the Wild West. And there's so many different disclosure, truth, UFO, patriot, what have you movements, little, you know, sub communities within a greater community, whereby it's perfect for scammers.
Yeah.
And delusional people too. Maybe they don't realize they're full of crap. They're just schizo delusional, or people who outright know they're full of BS, but they just want money or fame for themselves anyway.
Yeah.
No, we're in the Wild West. So these people are descending upon all of these movements, and it requires extra caution and extra discernment from the information consumer.
Seeker. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I compare it very much to the early 1900s spiritualist movement, you know, that occurred right at the turn of the century between the 1800s, 1900s. That Houdini fought so hard against, you know, And he was hated by those people, by spiritualists and people who would gladly bring you into a seance and make you believe that you were talking to your dead husband, things like that, and gladly take your money, giving you that experience supposedly in a darkened room, you know? But that's just it. And that's kind of what I prefaced this, beginning of this with, Jordan, is that idea of want of confirmation, the want of confirmation, not just the experiencer, but the believer in UFOs, UAPs, married with that oh so dangerous cognitive dissonance, that we all have in some way, shape, or form, where it's like we don't accept some information because it goes against our basic belief set, you know, or because it goes against what we have come to accept in our mind.
Two thoughts off what you just said. Number one, comparing it to the early 1900s spiritualist movement, I think the difference is now is that we have social media.
Yes.
And we have a way where these scammers can hide behind a camera, hide behind a screen, tell their narrative to the public, and then they don't have to face, you know, it's a narrative war now. They don't have to face anybody in person or get called out face to face. They can hide behind a camera and twist stories as much as they as much as they see fit. So, which is a blessing and a curse, because how fast information can travel on the internet, while scammers can scam at a light speed rate, we can also expose their scams much faster as well. So, you know, and also you brought up a perfect point of the confirmation or the validation that we want. We hear this claim of, gosh, we could go down the list of 1,000 of them, whether a quantum financial system exists, or Nazara is going to save the world, or insiders and mass arrests are going to happen, or aliens are going to come down or save us all, or whatever the case. People tend to believe that kind of stuff. They think they're believing it because they think it's hopeful. I met a lot of people who believed Corey or still follow David Wilcock because they think it's hopeful information. It's what they tell themselves to feel good. But I think at the root, they're actually terrified. They're terrified of not knowing, terrified about the way the world's going. They're scared. So they get hooked onto this hopium, we could call it.
I love that term.
Essentially, that term. This empty information that is more or less fake, wrong, scammy, and they gravitate towards it, they hook onto it, they think it's true because they think it's hopeful, when really it's actually based on fear. And this, you know, this hopium grabs people. And again, just like you said, you were talking about Houdini, the person who speaks the hard truths, they usually get very attacked and ridiculed.
They get a punch in the gut
because of that cognitive dissonance. Yes.
Yeah, they get a punch in the gut, and a broken liver is what they get.
Yep.
You know, and literally it's one of those, like, I see it in so many communities, Jordan, and it's one of those I've worked the conspiratorial side of news. I've worked mainstream news, and the whole reason that I cover things the way that I cover them is to try to demystify them for the average person. You know, to go into a topic like we are tonight, and to go into something that really rose to rapid and rampant success in the world. I mean, to the point where Corey Good was, and I'm a lifetime MUFON member, man. Like, I go to MUFON and cover their show every year, their conference, all kinds of stuff. I'm very, very close with MUFON. And to know that Corey Good was there as a presenter a few years ago, you know, like when Richard Dolan in the footage in the documentary is like, I can't believe that this is here right now. You know, that's something to be considered, because how did that happen? Like, we just did a whole episode on the Lou Elizondo kerfuffle and his picture, you know, that was I work in ballrooms all the time. Yeah, man, that
Hasn't
is totally
been,
a chandelier.
Two pictures now he's promoted.
Yeah. And that's just it. You know, like how is somebody in the world of intelligentsia who's made his bones in that and is living in that for decades now, how can he just utterly trust a source? You know, to the point that much like David Wilcox, who was very, very well respected. And there's still a lot of David's work that I respect, you know, but once you have him fully backing Corey the way he did and pushing Corey and really shoving Corey not only down a network's throat, but down other people's throat and backing him and backing him and backing him, all it does is chip away at the foundation of a damn well-founded career, Jordan, you know?
So what's the ultimate motive for these people that do these sorts of things? Is it, I think it can just boil down to fame and money.
Pretty much. And sadly, you know, because these are people that, once again, I say people, specifically person. Right now I'm speaking of David Wilcox, somebody who was fully entrenched and embedded in the world of disclosure, capital D, fully entrenched and embedded in the world of UFO UAP research, all kinds of things. So when you have that happen, that is a hacking blow to the cause, you know, because now you've got somebody whose work has been trusted, whose work has been leaned upon by other people, and they did not fully vet sources, you know?
Indeed. I think if David stuck to his alternative science work that he was doing between 2005 and 2010, if he stuck to that, it would have been great. You know, things would be a lot different now, and we wouldn't be having this kind of conversation and saying these things about him. But it looks like he just went on his own path of choices, and here's the consequences. Now, in terms of, you know, when you see these people who let their work get tainted by bad choices, I guess we could say, it is sad to the overarching disclosure movement or whatever respective community they're in, but it's a good spiritual test for the followers, though, as well.
Sure.
It's a good lesson in discernment. I've learned, especially in the UFO space, I've learned not to really trust anybody except you, Chris.
Oh, well, thank you.
But that doesn't mean that people who I might think are totally compromised or blackmailed or control opposition or scammers, whatever the case, that doesn't mean they don't put out good information.
That's right.
And you can learn a lot of good information from somebody who's a shitbag or somebody who is a deep state shill or whatever the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't just not listen to them. You, as Bruce Lee said, you take what's useful, reject what's useless, add what's uniquely your own.
That's right.
I'm just going to be very careful with me having a platform with however many followers I do. I'm going to be very careful as to who I choose to amplify on that platform, but I'm still going to learn from, you know, every so often I go back to David Wilcox old books from many years ago, or I'll listen to some Greer lecture from 10 years ago or something like that. So there's still good info you can take from people who are questionable of character.
Yeah.
And it's a good lesson in just the nature of, I guess, our mental spiritual capacities, like not letting ourselves get emotionally caught up and invested in people who we've never met before, who we have no idea who they are, letting ourselves get our energy sucked by these basically psychic vampires.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good spiritual lesson in that. So there's good things to take from it, as well as, you know, the sadness of them muddying the waters of disclosure, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. You know, it really is the idea, because I speak about it pretty regularly, not just on this show, but on other shows that I guest on. And that's the idea that we as hosts, Jordan, have a different onus put upon us. Mm-hmm. You know, I can hypothesize anything I want as long as I'm telling people it is my hypothesis.
Yeah.
It's my personal belief. This is what I think, what have you. But the second that you start pulling things out as this is a fact, this will be happening in 2025. You end up in a very painted corner very rapidly with a bunch of wet paint around you, you know, and it can be hard to A, squeeze or shoehorn that prediction into what actively happens in the world. And B, you can be misleading and misguiding a bunch of people who actively follow what you say, you know?
100%. There's a huge responsibility we have with these platforms. And, you know, it depends on how you sort of frame your persona to an audience. If you're just a general host who has anyone on for conversations, and even some people you don't agree with you have on for conversations.
Yeah.
That's going to be a little different than the individual whose persona they create as being like a truth reporter, right?
Yes.
But regardless, whether you frame yourself as just like a general conversational host or like an investigator, however it is, there's still a responsibility to, like you said, frame things in the correct manner and use those magic words in broadcasting, opinion and allegedly, as much as you can.
That's right. That's right.
Right, right. And yeah, just a lot of these influencers don't use their platforms responsibly at all. And I saw, you know, I just saw plenty of people in the UFO space do that, primarily Corey and David, because I work with them for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And I just saw them completely be irresponsible with what they were telling people, what they were putting out publicly, and also how they were behind the scenes. Like, I was just looking at them. These are supposed to be spiritually evolved people. And I didn't see evidence of that.
Yeah, yeah. Much more locker room than spiritually involved.
I'm all for locker room, and I think even locker room can be spiritually evolved, but again, it's like, what are you selling to the public?
And then it's the dichotomous face.
100%.
You know, and being genuine to who you are and what you portray. And that's just it. You know, it becomes, once again, the idea of if you're greeting lines of people at something like Disclosure Fest, and people are paying $100 to have their picture taken with Corey Good, you know, the same way that they do with William Shatner or anything like that at a pop culture festival, you know, coming up to have their book signed, and oh my God, your experience changed my life. You know, your experience echoed my experience. And he looks him in the eye and says, absolutely. I'm glad you saw the blue feathered avians as well. You know, at some point that's a little maniacal, you know, more than a little snake oily, and really something that is predatory upon people that he even himself in his deposition calls delusional. He's like, you know, if these people say that they've met these blue avians or that they've been through a 20-year regression program, they're delusional. These are things that I made up.
I laugh every time I talk or think about his deposition.
Oh,
just
God.
Because knowing Corey is a very sly person, and he's very strategic in his thinking. He's always trying to figure out what to tell people to, you know, get them on his side, I guess you could say. So when I look at that deposition, I'm just like, I'm thinking of what Corey's trying to think of, and it's like I can see Corey sitting there trying to plot to himself, well, if I claim these things are real, the judge and the lawyers are going to think I'm batshit crazy. So I've got to frame this in a way where the judge and the lawyers aren't going to think I'm nuts, but I'm also going to get my, you know, get my case won and all this sort of stuff. It just makes me laugh thinking of him trying to plot that.
and you know, my favorite thing is when he and his lawyer go, and like literally, folks, if you go watch the deposition footage, like the first 10 minutes is him trying to get it suppressed. you know, like the whole first 10 minutes of it is, well, this isn't for public. Like this isn't publicly available. This isn't part of public record. No, this is a deposition. It is absolutely part of public record. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, no. Well, you know, is it going to be sealed? Like, no, it's a deposition. It's absolutely not sealed. But yeah, the same exact fight. Like, how can we turn this to our favor right now? And it's almost comical to watch some of it, because it really does speak to the mentality of how willing he was and still is to continue a deception, to make money.
Yeah, truly. I mean, there's just going this far down the path. I mean, can't get off it now. He's too deep. You know, he's too deep. And a lot of other people out there are too deep in their scam they sold the public. Because coming out with your face on the internet, it's something a lot of people don't realize the gravity of.
Yeah.
You know, putting your name and face out there, things posted publicly. The internet is more or less forever.
Yeah.
Aside from, you know, if you say the wrong things on big tech, I guess. But no, those videos will still get saved and
oh, they're posted still there.
Yeah. They're still there somewhere.
Oh, they're still there.
They're still there. So, yeah. I mean, this is not just an example within disclosure media, but I mean, bad example here, but it's perfectly analogous, is like these middle-aged moms who start doing OnlyFans, and it's like, that's, you're not knowing how that's going to affect you 10, 20 years down the line. You're not thinking about that.
But. Well, I mean, there are teachers getting fired for it, you know, and it's one of those like, well, you know, maybe if you paid the teacher a decent enough salary, they wouldn't have to have a friggin' OnlyFans channel. there's a random thought, but
the same thing in this conspiracy media, you know, world now on social media, is that people are putting these stories out there. And then once you start doing it and you go far enough down that path, like, it's going to limit. It's like tattooing your face or tattooing your arms, getting a full sleeve, right? Like, it's going to severely limit your choices later in life.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, and there are numerous cautionary times. I mean, InfoWars is one of them. The cautionary tale of beware of what you say and how you say it on broadcast. Because what Alex has boiled down to was a call to action. You know, like, if you don't believe me, contact them yourself. That is a call to action to people. So that
especially if you've got a platform of millions, you better be responsible with what you say on that platform to millions of people. So
exactly.
You know, I don't know if I feel all that bad for the whole InfoWars crowd, because
I am a former on-air producer there. And no, I don't feel horrible about what happened because of how it happened. Mm-hmm. You know, there were numerous people that were like, yeah, you probably shouldn't say that. And because you can say, once again, it is my belief all day long. But as soon as you say it is fact, things have a different weight to them. Things pull a different way. And that's exactly what it was. One of those that when I saw the lawsuit from Corey happening, it was like, this is audacious. I cannot believe that this is happening right now. So it's pretty fascinating to see. And once again, one of those that when you're talking, even the same way we were talking about Lou Elizondo a minute ago, like, what does that do for his reputation? Could it be that the person that gave him those photos was trying to set him up and partially discredit him? Sure, could be, but it also kind of knocks him down a peg as far as, how did you not vet your source? You know, 100%. And when it comes to a media distribution company putting out media, putting out film, putting out things like that, yes, it does have a disclaimer at the beginning. You know, none of this is the opinion of Gaia TV or, you know, anything like that. It pushes a fine line as well. And it's one of those, what does it do for Gaia's reputation as far as putting that out there, and not just putting it out there, but boosting it to the top. You know?
Yeah, I find that disclaimer to be such hot air, blowing smoke at us, right? It's not our opinion, but we're going to decide to put it out there anyway.
Yeah.
Like, don't give me that, right? You could decide to not air this, but it's all about the content. It's all about the content,
and
the hours watched, the amount of clicks you get.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What I found with Gaia, again, one of those outlets I view as entertainment. They've got some good info on their platform, but at the end of the day, it's not an informational outlet. It's for entertainment. And some of their vetting at Gaia is trash. So
yeah. And that's just it. Like I've subscribed to Gaia. I've watched their meditation stuff. I've watched numerous of their courses.
I went to their headquarters and filmed an episode with George Nouri there.
Yeah.
You know, but, I upset the Contact in the Desert crowd. And when I upset that crowd, I guess I upset Gaia and they took down my episode there. And
yeah,
I kind of got censored by them too. It's kind of a funny story, but, anyway, well, in terms of what's that?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, when I spoke at Contact in the Desert in 2019, I think I might've got a little too political for their taste and ruffled their jimmies a bit. So they refused to put out a DVD of my talk. And I have the photo of their DVD counter selling everybody's DVDs, and mine said unavailable with a little post-it note on it. So I took a picture and I posted it on Twitter and I tagged Contact in Desert, like, why isn't my DVD out? And they claimed it was because I said the F word in my talk.
Oh. F-word.
Well,
yeah.
Somebody recorded my whole talk.
No.
Prove them to be lying.
Yeah.
And also,
I don't see that.
They invited
transcript.
Laura Eisenhower there and she curses like a sailor and they put out her DVD. So I don't understand. and then, so I called them wrong and liars and they blocked me. Contact in the Desert blocked me on social media. And then Gaia took down my interview with Nouri. It's just funny. I think I talked a little too deep about, I think John Podesta and Hillary Clinton. They didn't like that.
Oh, yeah. A whole gate
so
thing.
I was talking UFOs, though.
Hey,
I mean, look at these people into UFOs.
That's where some of the first leaks came from was the Pizzagate documents. And not a lot of people realize that.
Yep.
You know, that is where a deep amount of stuff came from. And it's one of those, I said it on my show years ago before we rebranded, just the idea of, people were really, really upset about those emails, but nobody ever really denied what was in those emails.
Right.
Nobody ever denied it.
Food code words and all that weird stuff, but all the 0-point energy talk with Podesta too. And it's like, both of those things.
Yeah.
So ever since then, and ever since the New York Times came out with their articles in 2017 about ATIP, I've just always been scratching my head cautious about this mainstream government UFO disclosure.
Yes.
I just get the feeling it's a big limited hangout.
Mm.
It's half truth designed to cover up more stuff.
I think that yes. Yes, absolutely, Jordan, and I firmly agree. I think that we will, as I've said on my show the last couple of weeks since the hearings, I think that we will eventually, and what a lot of this is accountability, follow the money, so that we can eventually end up with a Nolly North fall guy from either an alphabet agency or contractor thereof with his hand up saying, yes, it was me. I let it. I'm sorry. You know, you aren't going to see, like, a tube with an alien come out and then pull a sheet off and go, aha, there it is. That's not going to happen. Big D disclosure is going to be a legal thing. And we're going to find somebody who the purse strings lead to that we can then choke with the purse strings until they give us somebody to hold accountable, you know?
Yeah. I like the way you put that, because what I'm seeing at the mainstream level, one of the things that's really made me question it is that you've had numerous sort of UFO Twitter, UFO legacy influencers, but also the mainstream media, New York Times and all of them. One of their prime narratives is that, well, these things we're seeing in the sky, these UAPs, they could be China, Russia. They could be aliens, but we know for a fact they're definitely not U.S.-made technology. We don't have this. It's not ours.
Yeah.
Which I call BS on that one. I think the Black Project many decades ago were doing R&D with exotic propulsion, electrophoretic technology. But at the same time, it's kind of this spectrum. You got one polarity of the mainstream UFO movement that's just like bubblegum disclosure. But then on the other polarity, you have your Corey Goods and your super space secret super soldier 20 and back people.
Yeah.
And I'm somewhere in the middle where I think what the government and mainstream media is giving us in regards to UFO disclosure is just purposely watered down to cover more up. And then you've got these crazy delusionals on the way other side of the spectrum, fabricating a bunch of crap. You might even have some COINTELPRO assets purposely putting out that crazy conspiracy 20 and back crap.
Yeah.
To muddy the waters.
Yep.
And but in both sides is this continuum that they want people to be on either end of that spectrum.
Yeah.
So they're not in the middle, you know? Do I think we have a breakaway civilization on the back of the moon and Mars and all that? Probably not. But do I think that ATIP is the only UFO program the government's ever had and there's no way the U.S. has this technology? Definitely not as well.
Yeah.
I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I think corporate contractors have made working flying saucers, ARVs, whatever you want to call them. Probably a few of them. Probably not 1,000 of them with 20 and back programs.
Yeah.
But I definitely think some of these things in our skies are ours, and they've had this technology for many decades.
Yeah.
And they've siphoned off billions of dollars from the budgets through $10,000 hammers and $12,000 coffee cups to help fund those black projects.
Yeah, no, precisely. And the example that I give is, yes, there has been a secret space program. There's been one for years. Yeah. How do you think the X-37B, like when we heard about it, was when it landed from a successful 2-year mission overhead, the first successful 2-year unmanned mission came back from. So it's like, whoa, they just kind of launched it and never told us. It was over our heads secretly for the U.S. Air Force for 2 years.
And what about the things that don't need wings and they don't need rockets to launch, right?
Yeah.
They could easily keep those secret.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's just it, you know, I think that things like Stephen Greer's statements about Betty and Barney Hill recently, stuff like that, these things are being given to us to literally drive a wedge in the community, to drive a wedge in the experiencer community, to possibly discourage experiencers from coming forward since they're getting so comfortable, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. If anything conspiratorial, I think that would probably be the case. The fact of, yes, people like Lou Elizondo are being fed bad pictures so that it discredits them and discredits that part of the movement, that kind of stuff. So that is full on active psyops. And we know that we have those, like they said in the government oversight committee a week or so ago. That is who answers the ATIP phone line is a PSYOP operator. So it's literally a PSYOP officer that is the public relations officer. So
it's like the nothing to see here guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. The great Jedi mind trick gentleman. So, we have to be wary of those things. We have to be willing once again to accept somebody's story prima facie, but make sure you got a good pinch of salt with you too, you know, to enjoy that story with, because you've got to be willing to see the other side of things, Jordan. We have to be careful with our want of confirmation. We have to be careful where these things lead us, because otherwise, yes, we do end up with what is the equivalent of false prophet when it comes to people like Corey Good, people who truly led a different charge of things. That ended up to be an utterly, utterly horrifying dead end of a rabbit hole, you know, for a lot of people.
Right. And community is important. Community is a very important thing to harbor and to have.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we need to be very careful in not letting that community become a cult.
Yes.
And letting scammers spread in the community just because, you know, we don't want to be negative. That's a common New Age BS term. I don't want to be negative. So
yeah, yeah.
I don't want to hurt people's feelings or upset people with hard truth. So I'm going to avoid it. No, we need to look out for the community, call out these scammers, call out the wolves in sheep's clothing.
That's right.
When they're trying to attack. But at the same time, we also need that balance and that humility where I'm not just going to call out everybody for the sake of calling out everybody. Right. So, you know, that community is very important to have and foster, but we can't let it become, again, that sort of cult-like thinking, cult-like mindset, because there's cult-like thinking everywhere in society.
Oh, absolutely.
Science, religion, spiritual groups, political groups, everywhere.
That's it.
So just need to be very careful. At the end of the day, it just comes down to being able to manage our emotions properly. And a lot of people have a difficult time with that. At the subconscious level, maybe consciously they think they can handle their emotions, but subconsciously there's still fears. There's still a lot going on there that they're not necessarily aware of. So it just comes down to that self-awareness, that emotional management, so you can properly use that logic brain and critical think through this stuff.
Well, and that's just it. It is that critical thinking part, and it is that idea, you know, one of the things that we probably pulpit preach more than anything on this show, Jordan, because I founded Curious Research, is the idea of, you know, science begins with experience. Mm-hmm. Like it begins with you have observed something, begins with an observation. So from there, you gather data and things like that, and then you form a hypothesis. But you've got to gather data. You've got to gather more data than just the experience. What you have from your ghost hunt is points of datum. You don't have evidence yet, you know, and we have to be very careful with what we call evidence. Because if we call everything evidence, then science is not going to categorize things, you know. It can all be evidence. I'm sorry for those of you that are out there in the side of Texas and recording something at 3 a.m. every single morning. That is probably not an anomaly. It seems pretty scheduled. If you're videotaping between 3 and 3:30 every morning and catching something in the sky, odds are not an anomaly. You know, and that is something that you have to be willing to accept, like off the surface and move forward from. And yes, whether it be paranormal or cryptid or UFO, UAP, Jordan, that is something that we in the communities have to be willing to do. We submitting the picture have to be willing to accept the explanation of what we put the red circle around, you know?
Very good points there, my friend. Very good.
Before we let you go, let everybody know, because we got you for about another 3 minutes, let them know where they can go to follow you, where they can go to contact you if they have a whistleblowing story that they would like to share or anything like that, Jordan?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is jordansather.com, JORDANSATHER.com. You can email me through there if you do want to contact me with any kind of stories or anything you feel like you want to share. The best social media account is probably on Twitter or X or whatever they're calling it these days. It'll kind of always be Twitter to me, but Jordan_Sather_ on there. So I do thank Elon for letting me back on that platform. I got
nice.
I got banned from it and everything else at the end of 2020. And he let me on after he bought it. So whoever let me back on. So yeah, those are probably the two best areas to contact me or message me or whatever the case. And it was great talking to you tonight, Chris, about, you know, these kind of, I don't call them supernatural, because to me, the idea of higher intelligence throughout the cosmos seems very natural.
Yeah.
It does not seem paranormal. It seems very normal. And, you know, I do a lot of work in, I guess, the political health freedom realm. So it's just good to talk about these sorts of things again. I'm very interested in these subjects. So I appreciate the conversation, and I appreciate you having me on to get a lot of that catharsis off my chest as well, because I did get taken advantage of.
You got raped,
being young and dumb.
You got raped over the coals pretty hard, film-wise and things like that. And it's hard lessons. Honestly, it's one of those that, whether you can see all the music production stuff over my shoulder, I do film, I do video. It's one of those the only way you learn that is the hard way. And every one of us has that story of, oh yeah, man. Yeah, I remember that. Because we all remember it because it happened to every single one of us. There's not a one of us that it hadn't happened to at some point. So, good on you for getting it done early in your career and moving on to such amazing things that are truly, truly, expose pieces like A Dark Alliance, The Inside Story of the Cosmic Con. Stop on by Prime Video, folks. You can tell that they're really in it for the money, and that's the only reason why they're in it, because it's 99 cents an episode. All right? That's how you can tell that that's all that they're about, is the cash, not the truth.
Yeah, and I do real quick before we sign off, or I sign off, I want to thank Darcy, the director of that film, for... He did an ungodly amount of research, and he spent multiple years putting that together and gathering information, gathering good evidence, different kinds of evidence, and all that. So, yeah, Darcy did a great job with that film, and I hope that he does more episodes, and I'd love to be in more episodes for it. But, yeah, two episodes are out now, Dark Alliance on Prime Video for a whopping 99 cents.
Yeah. Like I said, you can tell that you're truthers because you're like, well, we got to charge something for it, man. Yeah. you got to make something. The fact that it's 99 cents an episode, entirely awesome. It is a fantastic, fantastic foray into this story. And you guys, Darcy, you did an amazing job. Jordan, amazing job with this. Kudos to you guys for really, really getting this out there in the community. I think it is a huge conversation that we need to have. It's beyond an elephant in the room. It's a charging rhino in the room, and we all need to pay heed to it and pay attention. So thank you. Thank you so much for your candid conversation tonight, Jordan. I greatly appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
Absolutely. While you are online checking out everything about Dark Alliance and Jordan Sather, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find all of the YouTube channels of our guests on curiousrealm.com/videos. When we come back from this quick break, we will be joined by our pre-recorded guest, Bertie Jaworski. We will be talking about her remote viewing method of transdimensional mapping, what that is about, and the world of remote viewing as it pertains to UFO research. How can we utilize this amazing mental martial art for the cause of good in UFO research? Right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you so much for hanging on through that quick commercial break. And thank you also so much to our sponsors, especially WebWorks Wireless. If you have a camp, if you're a traveling technician like myself, if you do traveling broadcasts, stop on by and check out WebWorks Wireless. They have some fantastic packages that will get you up and running. There are zero caps. I've literally done like 8 hours of live streaming and never had my stuff throttled. It's absolutely amazing. Stop by and buy. Check them out. WebWorksWireless.com is the website that you want to go to. While you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by NoRivets.com. That is the website of our guest in this segment, the amazing Bertie Jaworski. She is a remote viewer by trade, and we will be talking about the world of remote viewing as it pertains to ufology and UFO investigation, as well as other paranormal things. Welcome to the show, Bertie. How are you doing today?
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on. I am having a wonderful day.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I had a chance to meet our mutual friend on the recent remote viewing cruise, and it was an absolute joy talking with him. And man, to be able to look you up and see what you're doing and to have followed you since, it's amazing to see what you do with transdimensional mapping. Before we get started with that and with how things relate to the world of ufology, how did you come to the world of remote viewing to begin with, Bertie?
I first found out about remote viewing when it was declassified by the U.S. government in 1995. At that point, it was in the news everywhere the government had a secret program where they were training soldiers to become psychic spies. The program was called Stargate. And all of these psychic spies in the program had just reached retirement age and were getting out into the public, and the program was declassified. Now, at the time, the Department of Defense said, well, it kind of worked, kind of didn't work well enough to keep pouring money into this program. So we have ended it. Now, I don't believe they actually ended.
Yeah.
Research into remote viewing, but they ended that version of the program. And when I saw this on the news, I thought, my gosh, I absolutely 1000% have to learn this. I happened to be living in Atlanta, Georgia at the time, and there was a sociology professor named Dr. Courtney Brown, who was a professor at Emory University there. And he was just starting a training institute to train people in this amazing technology. And he called his group the Farsight Institute. And he had just been trained, just fresh off the boat, been trained by Major Ed Dames, one of the military psychic spies.
Yeah.
And Dr. Brown had set up this training institute. I took his first class, and I kind of bartered with him because I didn't have any money at the time. And I traded remote viewing training for building his first website.
Oh, wow.
And, awesome. Yeah, it was pretty fun. And it ended up I was good at it. I just had a natural talent for remote viewing, and I worked my way up the ranks at Farsight, became the vice president there. And I eventually left to start my own organization, Transdimensional Systems, which was the first remote viewing consultancy on the planet. I trained people all over the world, thousands of people in all different countries. But I also gathered together a group of people I had trained, quite a number, at least 200 people who had taken training in remote viewing and wanted to do real life work. And we did. We worked for police departments, other law enforcement agencies. We worked for corporations. We worked for private individuals. We had so much fun. And I eventually left the field entirely and kind of went underground in a way, changed the name I was going by, and was out of the public eye for 22 years solid. I never stopped remote viewing, and I kept researching and looking into it and practicing it at least twice a day in all that time. And I came back out of the shadows a few months ago, mainly because people started to figure out where I was and who I was because of my UFO group getting so much attention. So here I am.
Well, and you know, things happen for good reasons, and proper timing in the universe happens for good reasons, Birdie. Because right now there is an amazing world going on with recent UFO hearings, all that kind of stuff. Even though a lot of people in the UFO UAP community are very disenchanted with the hearings that have occurred, it's one of those like, yeah, but even the confirmation of people being injured by recovery programs, even though they can't confirm the recovery programs, they can confirm the injuries and the payouts for those injuries.
Chris, you're so right. I cannot believe how far we have gotten along the disclosure timeline since 2017.
Yep. Yeah.
I think, you know, when you're in the thick of it and you've been following this your whole life and that first New York Times article came out in 2017. And if you've been following it on a day-to-day basis, you're waiting for that big foot to drop. You're waiting for the president of the United States or some other big nation, their world, their leader to come out and say the UFOs are real. And here is the evidence. And since we haven't had that, I know there's a lot of disappointment, but I am on team. Yes, we're doing it.
That's right. That's right. Because, you know, it is a slow and steady process, and much like I akin this very much to the world of remote viewing and the fact of, you know, even whenever I spoke on the remote viewing conference, most people know the declassification of Stargate, and they know the headline about 5 years late, not even 5 years, about 3 years later, of the stock market of silver, the silver market headline, where remote viewers had regularly predicted the silver market prices and the raises in the silver market. And those are really the only two headlines that they know. And yeah, most people think, you know, like, well, the government got rid of this because they found it non-efficacious. There was nothing useful. And it's like, well, not really. There was quite a bit that was actionable that they did use. The thing is, much like many programs, once you find out they can be used for so many things, you stop funding them in that way. And then they go off to contractors, you know,
exactly,
and you hire contractors who now employ them. And things like that. So yeah, you know, there are tons. I know no less than 10 different remote viewers that work for various Trigraph agencies, things like that, be it for helping find missing children, helping track down human traffickers, all kinds of things. So it is actively employed and deployed in the field, Birdie.
Yes, it is, Chris. Absolutely. I know many people who have worked for a variety of federal agencies. I myself have done significant work for all kinds of law enforcement from the local to the federal level. And they are always looking for any technology, whatever it is, that can give them an edge, that can answer a question that they can't answer through conventional means. And here we are, remote viewers. We're ready to take it on.
well, and it's interesting because once again, our world of science is rapidly catching up with remote viewing and things that, you know, Hal Puthoff put in papers years ago. The idea of quantum entanglement I spoke of a lot in my presentation, and the idea that, you know, this is beyond time. It's pretty fascinating once you start digging into the laboratory work in remote viewing and things like that. And the idea of being able to look at events that have happened, things like that. And I kind of want to start our conversation into the world of UFOs and remote viewing with a recent session that you did on the Tic Tac incident. Now, how did you come to be targeted with that, Birdie?
I recently taught a class here in Albuquerque, New Mexico in October. It was a 5-day class where I trained a group of students, most of whom had never remote viewed before and didn't even know a lot about it, but They had heard about me and wanted to learn, and they were from all over the world. There were a few trained remote viewers in the class. And at the end of class, on the last day, I said, guys, why don't you get together and pick something for me to remote view for you? And they escorted me out of the building and kept an eye on me to make sure I wasn't listening in. I was very far away, and they came up with the idea to task me with the David Fravor, Commander David Fravor, a commander in the U.S. Navy, hotshot fighter pilot, amazing person. And he encountered an object that he named the Tic Tac, which was a Tic Tac shaped, a cylindrical, rounded edges.
Yep.
White object had little feet on the bottom, and he saw it flying over the ocean. And this became the basis for that early disclosure article in 2017 when the videos of that Tic Tac were released. And he was interviewed, and he has since given testimony to Congress. So my students gave me that. Now, in remote viewing, as you know, Chris, you don't know what it is that you're going to be experiencing when someone gives you a target.
Yeah.
You don't know. It's called remote viewing blind.
Yeah.
Now, the person who gives you that target, they know what it is, or they may not. It may be double blind. It may be something someone comes up with somewhere else, and the person who gives you the target doesn't know what it is either. But in this case, my students knew. They didn't tell me anything. And I sat down and I did what I call transdimensional mapping. I didn't do a traditional remote viewing session.
Yeah.
I used my new techniques, in which you have an enormous piece of paper and multiple colored pens and crayons and markers. And I worked the target. And a few minutes in, I had figured out it was the Tic Tac because of the little feet sticking out of it. It's just so unmistakable. I knew it was the Tic Tac, but I kept going. And I put a little 7-minute excerpt of that session on YouTube, on my No Rivets YouTube. If anyone is interested in checking that out, you can watch me remote viewing, transdimensional mapping. Mapping is a particular type of remote viewing that you can incorporate even into traditional remote viewing methods. And my students had a blast. They all filmed me. And the reason I didn't post the whole thing was because there was some personal information about the commander and about some other things that came out in the body of the session. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's not appropriate to put online.
and Carl, our mutual friend, he's been through your transdimensional course, and I was fascinated to see his technique on the cruise, because I'm still, and even after seeing his, after seeing some of the way that my monitor works, because my monitor does not necessarily follow the hard protocoled controlled remote viewing, which is of course what I've been trained in, and even trying to go through that sometimes can be very hard and cumbersome. You know, like if you do not rigidly remember the exact steps in which things are done. And even like I had Angela Thompson Smith as my monitor, and she doesn't, she's very well trained in that protocol, but it's not necessarily the protocol that she follows or teaches either. So being tasked in that kind of way was very, very odd for me. So it's one of those exploring other ways. Like we were saying, it's very, very personal, the way that remote viewing happens. And even though you may be introduced to it in one fashion, another form may be what works better for you.
That's right. There are many different forms now since the original declassification of it. The first forms, of course, they called CRV, the standing for controlled or coordinate remote viewing. And it is a very strict protocol. And there are trainers out there and students of those trainers who stick to that very strict protocol and feel that it serves them extremely well. And then there are others, like I did back at Transdimensional Systems, you know, 25, 28 years ago, when I started my own company, I revised the military base system and started making it a little less militaristic, a little less patriarchal, and started encompassing different kinds of ideas and philosophies and protocols and really enjoyed it. And now I've moved on to what I call mapping. And I feel that this is something anyone can integrate into a session, regardless of what methodology you prefer. And like you say, Chris, it is so personal. Everyone has to find the school of thought that they resonate with and work it through that kind of method. You know, you have to pick and choose the things you like. I've had a number of people in my classes since I started teaching again that have taken training from all kinds of well-known remote viewers. And there's some of them are part of operational groups, you know, at Farsight or Future Forecasting Group and some of the others. And they had a blast and they plan to continue using my mapping techniques and some of my other techniques as a part of what they do going forward, which I think is just so cool.
Yeah. And it's very much, the same way Lynn Buchanan says it is a mental martial art. I see it very much, especially in the modern aspect, it is very much a mental mixed martial art in the way of like, you may learn Aikido, Judo, Taekwondo, and be mixing all of those together in order to come up with your own form that works for you, you know, and
it's, that's right. When you're in a fight, you're going to pull.
You're
going to
do whatever works. You're going to use whatever works. You know, you may have been trained in a protocol, but if this thing comes about while you're in session doing that, you shouldn't be ignoring it. You know,
that's right.
And it's kind of like ignoring your misses, you know, like you kind of have to not only celebrate your misses, but you have to pay attention to them and mark them and keep track of them, because that's how you learn. That's how you get better is through realizing those misses. Let's get into a little bit of what
I want to talk about the misses, because this is my big philosophy, Chris. My big philosophy can be reduced to these few words. You get what you get. I'm very vocal about this.
Yeah.
Actually don't believe there is such a thing as a miss in remote viewing. I actually do not. I've looked at tens of thousands of sessions over the past 30 years. And I have come to understand that what happens when you're remote viewing is, you know, you're building a language between your subconscious mind, whatever that is. There is no really accepted definition for that in the scientific community. So, you know, we'll call it your subconscious, that quiet voice inside. You're building a language between that and your waking consciousness. And most of the time, your subconscious is going to give you comparisons or a metaphor because you're looking and experiencing something you've never seen or experienced. So it'll throw things out. It'll say, it's like Disneyland or it's like the Taj Mahal. So you'll write that down. And I know in more traditional remote viewing methods, you know, you would call that an analytic overlay or deduction if you're at Farsight. But I consider that real data, and what my mapping does, it allows you to deconstruct that. So you figure out why your subconscious came up with that actually in the middle of the session. So you're able to like get rid of your misses, which are really just answers. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And yeah, you know, it is one of those that, because even during the session that we had, and Irva just recently posted it with the outbounder with the artwork from Keith Haring. And like the first thing that I wrote down was power. The whole piece of art was about power over other people. But after I wrote that and I started drawing things and started with a circle with spokes on it and that kind of stuff, I immediately started seeing a power generator and, you know, like a water wheel and, you know, an electric dam, things like that. So, it was interesting to see where my brain went with it. And that's kind of how I explain it to people. Cause I've practiced meditation for years, you know, lucid dreaming, all kinds of things. And a lot of people like that, but it must have been very helpful for you for remote viewing to have practiced that. And I'm like, oh, no, not really. Quite the opposite, actually, because you're trying to silence all of that when you're trying to get into the zone for lucid dreaming, when you're trying to get into the zone for hard meditation, you know, like you're trying to silence the monkey mind. Here you want to give the monkey a sketchbook. And like,
I love that.
Sketch it and write it down, monkey brain. Like, let it all flow. Let it all be connected. Nothing. And the example I gave at lunch on the cruise, somebody asked why I like remote viewing so much. And I was like, as a man in America, I get to write down my feelings unabashed on a piece of paper and nobody gets to judge me.
Oh, Chris, I love that. That is really funny and so true. And I like how you describe these differences between these different kinds of abilities that we have, because I've way back in the day, I was really into astral projection. Mm. And of course, I've spent years meditating. And you're right. These are all very different things. They're on a continuum, I think, with remote viewing.
They're connected, most definitely.
Like consciousness connection. But it's a different animal. Remote viewing's a little different.
Yeah. You're kind of reaching that same state, but in a different way, you know, because a lot of people, I make binaural beat music, things like that. A lot of people will use some of my tracks for astral projection to prepare themselves for a remote viewing session, you know, because the brain waves are pretty similar.
Yes.
However, the way you go about getting there is totally different, you know, and it's pretty fascinating to see that you can get your brain to the same brain space in a totally antithetical way, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
So, how did you first come to the world of UFO UAP studies, Birdie?
Oh, well, that I've been interested for even longer than I have been remote viewing since I was 7 years old.
Wow.
When I was seven, this was back in 1972. I'm aging myself here, which is fine. Everybody
knows
I'm old.
It's okay, I'm 75.
I'm an old lady. But I was... it was over Christmas break. I was with my sister, who's a year younger than I was, and we were playing. And this was in Massachusetts, where I grew up, and the snow was gently falling outside the window. The sun was setting. It was getting dark out. And we were playing with our Christmas gifts. We had gotten a Lone Ranger and a Tonto doll for Christmas. Of course, they call them action figures now, but back then they were dolls. We were playing. And this strange light came in through our bedroom window, and it was the weirdest color I had ever seen. It was grayish and bluish and greenish. It was almost sparkly, like it had glitter in it, but not quite. It almost had like light of its own. It came in through the window, and we dropped our dolls and turned to the window and looked outside, and we could see half of essentially a silver flying saucer.
Oh, wow.
A dull metallic we could see. And I was 7 years old. This was in the early 70s. Grew up in a religious family. I didn't know what it was. I had no language for it, no understanding. Mm. And we're staring at it. And all of a sudden, our dolls flew up in the middle of that light beam. They stood up on their own and lifted off the ground and started spinning in opposite directions. And that's the last thing my sister and I remember. And the next morning, we get up and we ran to the kitchen, and we're pulling on my mom's apron and saying, "Mom, mom, 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 mom," and telling her what we saw. And she just said, "Oh, you both had a bad dream. That's it." We gave each other the side eye like that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until years later, when I was at the public library looking at all kinds of books. I was a big reader, as I still am today. And I was in the, I was like 10, 11 years old. And there was a book that had been put out about UFOs, and it was kind of geared towards younger people. And it was a photo book that had pictures and drawings of things that people had claimed to see in the sky. And on the cover, it looked just like what we had seen. And I checked it out of the library, showed it to my sister, and we just sat there under the covers reading it cover to cover that night. And then I knew what it was. It was in my mind. Then I was like, wow, I was visited from people from another planet. That was my understanding, you know, as a kid. And since then, I've had more encounters. They say it runs in families, and that people, if you have encounters when you're very young, you may have them as you go through your life. And that has happened with me. And it's always kept my interest in.
Now, once again, as you said, the dolls started spinning, things like that, and that's the last thing you remember. Do you do you believe that you were just a witness to something that night, or do you believe you were taken that night, Birdie?
I suspect that I was taken. I really do. And just based on other encounters that I've had in later years, I do suspect that I was taken, and probably my sister as well. I've never undergone a hypnotic regression. Mm. Now, I have had people look at it using remote viewing, and the consensus seems to be, yeah, you know what? You were sucked up into a ship, lady.
Wow.
And probed, and, you know, the full range of abduction experience. And but I don't remember. And I'm not interested in exploring. Uncovering those memories. I'm happy with where it's at. I think it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, have you ever, I guess, felt anything adverse from that, or any trauma, anything like that? I mean, it doesn't really necessarily seem that way to me.
No, you know, when I was younger, maybe around 8 or 9, I remember there was a period of time. It was a few months when I was having the same recurring dream. And it wasn't until a few years ago when I remembered that dream. And I thought, oh, I bet that was related, because in this dream, I was outside and I was ice skating like we did as kids. And I skated up to this person and he had a mask on, and I ripped the mask off and he had another mask on, and I ripped that mask on, and I kept ripping masks on until I would wake up in terror, you know. And I do think that that was a way of me processing on some level this strange, you know, experience I had at 7 years old. So, but that's the only thing I could even point to as that I would consider traumatic. I think otherwise, to me, it's been interesting.
All right. And your experience specifically with remote viewing the Tic Tac event, what was your overall impression from that? Was it the idea that it was, our technology, that it was human in origin, or did you have a, I guess what they would now term NHI, non-human intelligence, behind it? What was your overall, what did you take away from that session? What things did you come up with there?
Yeah, it is not humane. It is not.
Let's
a
hope
human,
they are.
I know. Let's hope they're humane. Freudian slip there, right? Yeah. It did not come across to me as human made, or as any kind of even very advanced technology human made. Now, I have looked at a number of, I'll say, black ops type projects and things that our government or contractors and other government and their perhaps contractors, sure, or programs have in development now. And this is non-human. It was 100% non-human. It seemed to have a sentience, almost not like our sentience, but it did have some level of consciousness. And I even at some point in that session, as I'm describing, and I don't think this part is online, but I was describing to the students around me that I said, do you guys remember that TV series Farscape? I don't know if anyone out there has seen it, but it's a fantastic old show, has some puppets in it and, you know, humans, actors. But one of the main characters is the spaceship, and the spaceship has a name and a consciousness and can react on its own. And the Tic Tac came across that way to me as having a consciousness not like ours, very different. There did seem to be some kind of, I'll say, artificial intelligence component to it, not like the artificial intelligence that we understand today here on Earth, but we're still in our infancy with it. Seemed to be very advanced, but also seemed to have some kind of a actual consciousness, not just a machine made one.
Not necessarily the idea of like it was a drone under control, but that it was in control of itself. Not even the fact that it had an entity inside of the craft.
Yeah, it was under its own control. And that was one of the things that did come out in the session. Well, first of all, I also described a large number of these things under the ocean, kind of attached to, not inside, but attached to some kind of, I guess what you could call a mothership of sorts, or a home base of some sort.
Okay.
And so there were a number of these arranged on this larger craft, I'll call it, because it what that was able to move as well, though it seemed stationary at the time. And there were a number of these, and I recall describing during the session how each of these individual Tic Tacs was its own person in a way. It had its own identity and its own way of doing things. And they each had specific instructions and jobs that they were doing, but they had like their own agency. I think that's the word I use, their own agency.
Like a hive of bees, almost.
And I'm a beekeeper.
Yeah, literally there is a strata of bees in there. They all have a similar job, things like that. But the way that one gathers pollen from a flower is different than the way another one does. The way they carry it on their body is different the way another one does. They have a unified language and a unified goal at the end of things. But at the same time, that's something interesting, Birdie, because when I've asked Lynn Buchanan, whenever he's been on the show, if he has ever remote viewed alien life, one of the things that he told me was the fact that, yes, he had, and specifically had remote viewed the Greys, and was like, they're a hive mind, you know, and they've given up individuality. And the whole reason that they are utilizing us is to use our ingenuity to remake their technology and to adapt their technology, because they, as advanced as they are, they can make nothing new. They have no means of which to be ingenious or apply an old technology to something new, because they can't invent. They've given it up for a hive mind.
Yeah, I think that like how Lynn is describing that to you, that is so similar to how so many remote viewers have described the Greys over the last 30 years. Yeah. It seems no matter who it is, they describe something very similar to that. And I've experienced that too, looking at the Greys. It's kind of like the Borg in Star Trek.
Yeah. And, you know, whenever you consider a civilization that has gone interstellar in that kind of way, you know, you kind of do have to have that rote habit mentality. You can't, the individuality kind of goes away.
It does, especially if this is, non-human intelligence coming from other star systems. Well, depending on the kind of technology they're using and their understanding of physics, it may take a very long time for them to travel from one part of the galaxy to another. And in that time, they may have to replicate themselves, reproduce themselves. And over time, I would think that they would lose a sense of their innate civilization.
Yeah, no, precisely. And you know, with that in mind, especially with the recent hearings that have happened, Birdie, there were quite a few questions about USOs. There were quite a few questions about USO bases, like what you're talking about, where basically there was, like you said, almost a colony of these things cooperating together, being together under the water. Is that the first time that you've seen such things or anything like that in session?
Yeah, definitely not the first time. I had looked at underwater UFOs even 25, 26, 27, 28 years ago, long time ago. And it's been a thing of interest of mine over all of these years. I have looked at numerous encounters, USO encounters. And I'm very excited for Richard Dolan's new two-volume set coming out on USOs. I'm very excited to read that and to find some more things that I can explore.
Yeah, he is an extraordinarily level-headed individual. I love his work. It's always impressed me. And his body of work is voluminous. And especially with things going on now, it's fantastic to see a lot of things that he has said for quite a while being confirmed, that kind of stuff. There is a lot, I don't know, I personally believe that there is a lot of vindication going on right now with the panels that are happening.
A
lot of things that a lot of people have said for a long time are finally coming to light. So it's great to see that. And it's fantastic to see the way that these communities are coming to more light, not just UFO, UAP, but remote viewing as well. The fact that there has been a growing movement of remote viewing over probably the last decade. How has that changed remote viewing as you see it, Birdie, as somebody who's been involved for the last 30 years?
Well, back in the day, you know, before I left the public field, there was a lot of pushback from quite a number of people and from some government sources against anyone who was trying to do things outside the box.
Yeah.
I think they were trying to keep a lid on it. I was threatened. My children's lives were threatened. I had young children at home at the time. I had unmarked vans parked in my cul-de-sac. And it didn't happen to just me. It happened to people I was working closely with within my group. And it was terrifying, to be quite honest. It was terrifying. It's the reason that I went underground. And today, it's changed so much. Everyone in the field has been very welcoming, has been very kind. I am enjoying getting to know all the people that have come into prominence since I left the public field and seeing all the cool projects that people are doing, the ways people are experimenting, the ways that they're sharing their data. There's a lot of interesting projects out there. People are using it in all the same ways that I have over the years, but also they're using it for some interesting new applications, such as, you know, using it to predict cryptocurrency trends.
Yeah.
There's been a really interesting lot of cool stuff to see, and I'm very heartened by it. And I think at the time, too, 25 years ago and more, there weren't as many women in the field. And so there was a lot of male energy in the field. And, you know, there was some headbutting there, you know, being a woman and talking about things from a female perspective. But today, there are quite a number of super strong, interesting, intelligent, wonderful women in the field who are doing super cool things. You know, there's Lori Williams here in New Mexico who's training in CRV. We've got Deborah Katz, who's the president of IRVA, and she also trains people in CRV.
Yep.
And her psychic things as well. And you've got just a number of interesting women out there. So I think that that's a big advancement in the field.
It is fantastic. And it's great to see once again that building of community that's there now. There's still, I think, some muddled waters between the different varying techniques of remote viewing and those inner communities. But overall, I mean, one of the big things that I talked about and talk about regularly on shows is the idea of sharing research. And I think that for a long time, especially, despite the fact that there have been ongoing studies of remote viewing going on in selected places, I think that it sadly became one of the many communities where people became very isolative in their work. They became very self-checked in their work. It was no longer the idea of let's have a team of remote viewers. Let's have a group of remote viewers. Let's get together. Let's target things together as a group of three and have three of us monitoring, you know, and share that data and chronicle that together. And it's great to see it being pulled out of the vacuum and into the light of day. Because that is what it takes for these things to grow to new places.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've got my own group going now since I came back out into the public. And right now I've got, as of this morning, 74 people in my group.
Wow.
We have a cool website we call Mapping Mavericks. It's for students. And I'm doing ongoing student development. We have three operational groups. We just completed a little project that we're working with one of the Native American Pueblos here on a missing person case.
Cool.
And we have a little group now that's going to be working on kind of true crime things, looking for missing people, missing things that have been stolen, such as big artworks or Bitcoin or gold or what have you, looking for perpetrators that are on the run, you name it. And they're working on that. We also have another group that's focusing purely on looking and discovering new things about the UFO phenomenon. So I'm letting people have, you know, kind of their choice of what kinds of projects they're interested in doing. And we're all having such a great time together. Lots of cool conversations going on behind the scenes and some just absolutely stunning remote viewing being done by these folks.
That is fantastic to hear, because it is one of those that it can be a challenge to get somebody to be passionate about it. And I think some of that does come from some of the very hard protocol, remote viewing that's out there. Even with the CRV that I started with, I could see how somebody could find it very, very discouraging, you know, much like, you know, no different than going into any dojo and wanting to break a board and finding out like, oh, no. We got like 58 katas before you get anywhere near watching somebody break a board, you know, but you're like, we aren't even going to show you the board breaking demonstrations yet because we don't want you to get too psyched, you know, so I can see how a lot of people get very discouraged when they start out with remote viewing.
Yeah, it's like learning any kind of new skill, learning a second language or third or fourth language, or it's like learning a musical instrument. You know, it's a lot like learning the guitar. Everybody, you know, in remote viewing thinks, okay, the first time I do it, I'm going to draw a picture that looks exactly like the target. And I keep trying to temper everyone's, enthusiasm and say, hey, listen, you're going to do amazing, but you have to remember, there's 360 degrees around what's in that photo. There's a photographer that took that photo. There's all kinds of interesting stuff that you may be exploring when you are remote viewing this target. And so, and like playing the guitar. Yeah. You can maybe learn to play a couple of chords in a day, but they're not going to sound great because your fingers haven't built up the calluses. Yeah. And so it's like any skill. It takes practice.
and even the fact of, I mean, probably on the cruise was the first time that I sketched something. And I think some of that's just down to the fact of my 7-year-old sketches better than his father. It's like, it's stick figures, Bernie. God, I hope whatever I'm looking at is stick figures.
Hey, I'm with you there. I'm a stick figure kind of gal myself. I'm big on the language and less on the sketches.
That's just it. Like my poet brain takes over and I start going into textures and things like that and other descriptors, because I would love to be able to visually draw it down. That would be amazing. And I did do some stuff on the boat. It was really cool. And it felt really, really good to sketch something and have something come out in that kind of way. Until then, it had all been very, very much, not necessarily visual, but impression, you know, smells, feelings, sounds, that kind of stuff. That would come through to me. So it was much more descriptors of those. Oh my God, the word just left my head.
Chris, my problem. I always tell everybody in my classes that I think that you can break down any group of remote viewers into three subgroups. You have your people that are going to always be very visual. They come into it with that. They have this visual ability and they see things and they are able to sketch things beautifully from the get-go. And then you have another group that I like to call conceptual remote viewers. And these are your people that just know things. They know what's going on. They know the importance of it, the meaning behind it. They get all the kinds of impressions you're talking about. I would be willing to bet you're a conceptual remote viewer. And I am too. And then The other kind, the third kind, is an emotional remote viewer. And these people are the ones that really connect with the emotions of the beings, the people or the animals or aliens, depending on what you're looking at, sure, at a place, or just the deep emotional imprint of a place, such as if you're looking at a Civil War battleground or a concentration camp. And, you know, today, even though these atrocities happen, say, in World War II, you can still feel that deep sadness and horror at a place. And so and everyone's a combination of all three types, but everyone is kind of primarily one of those three types. And I found that being a conceptual remote viewer, it took me a very long time to become great at the visual part, that I worked on it.
Yeah, and you know, let's explore that for a second. Like, how does somebody begin to figure out which one they may be?
Oh, I can peg everybody after one session. If you are looking at your work, you do a remote viewing session and you are doing more sketches than you are language, you are almost certainly a visual remote viewer, because some people, it just translates that way. And when you look online at, you know, people like to post sessions online, whether it's on, you know, X or wherever, different forums out there, Reddit, you name it, and they'll post work that they think is incredible, and it's almost always a sketch. You don't get a lot of people just posting a lot of language. You get the sketches, and that's kind of, I think, come into the public mind is what remote viewing looks like. And so I like to tell students that it's way more than that. So somebody who's getting those sketches off the get-go, they're visual. If you're getting a lot of conceptual data, if you understand what is happening and why it's happening, you're conceptual. And if you are just like feeling it in your body and the tears are coming, you're emotional. And I always get all three in a class. It's really cool. And what's cool is operationally, you put those three kinds of people together and you can describe literally anything. It takes all three kinds.
Yeah. And that's just it. The idea of, once again, having a team of people, because it's no different than having a proper science lab. You know, like you want different people to be able to bounce these ideas off of. You want different people to have different concepts of the same target. Because, you know, as Len says, somebody may be better at smelling something while another person may be better at tasting something, you know, or feeling it. So these different sensory perceptions are hugely important, no different than understanding as a teacher whether somebody is a visual, tactile, or auditory learner, you know.
Exactly.
If you know how that kid learns, you can now curb the curriculum to them, you know, and make it stick so much more.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And it's like any kind of work out there, it generally takes a team effort to do something that's meaningful and important.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we have you for about 15 more minutes, Birdie. Let's start exploring the idea of targeting and specifically the idea of front loading. Because I think a lot of people, there are a lot of groups out there on social media. There's a lot of, I think a lot of sensationalized remote viewing going on.
there is.
Whenever it comes to a lot of the paranormal world, things like that. And just so people understand what a remote viewing session is and the difference between that and a front loaded remote viewing session.
Yeah. So in a blind remote viewing session, you literally have no clue whatsoever what's happening when you start. You're given a random number, perhaps to begin with, and then you do a quick little doodle with your hand, and that's called an ideogram. And it's essentially kind of, it's this secret knowledge that we have inside our bodies, how we understand and order the world. So, you know, you draw a quick wavy line. Well, it usually means that there is water present, or a little loop-de-loop means probably there's some kind of sentient somebody there.
Yeah.
So you start with that and you start getting your sensory impressions, and it goes on, sketches and descriptions. Now, front loaded is an entirely different animal. I don't recommend it for new people to remote viewing, because you have to understand your mind really well to do a front-loaded session. In a front-loaded session, you know what it is. Somebody would tell you, yeah, I want you to remote view the tic-tac incident. So you sit down with your paper and pen and you know that's what you're remote viewing. And if you do it front-loaded, and even for experienced remote viewers, I think front-loading is difficult because you cannot help but put your own ideas about what's there.
Thank you.
On the page.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was going to say. Even as an experienced remote viewer, how do you remove preconceived notion? How do you remove even the idea of going down a fantastical storyline? You know, anything like that? Because yes, you know, you do want the, once again, to give the monkey brain a pen and paper. However, you don't necessarily want them to write a narrative.
Yeah, it's very easy and too easy, to be honest, if you're doing it front loaded, to put your own interpretations of things in there, or to run off down a pathway that it's going to be very hard to come back from. And so I really recommend remote viewing blind, although I do remote view front loaded.
Sure,
I really
sure.
do on some projects. And one thing that I have worked on for the past 10 years is I've been monitoring my brainwave patterns
awesome.
While I remote view, and I
awesome.
Remote view twice a day. I have a couple of devices. I use a Muse, which
yep.
is a consumer grade, kind of EEG device that it was built for, you know, people to learn, use biofeedback to train themselves to meditate. And there have been some third party apps that have been developed for the Muse. So you can literally see the raw data, see what your brain is actually doing any given
cool.
moment. Yeah. It's
cool.
really cool.
I
also
have quite a few of them on my tablet for my Muse.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
And so what I've been doing, and I have over 10,000 sessions now that I've done using the Muse.
Awesome.
I video myself doing the session. So I have the timestamps and record my brainwave patterns. And so I can go back and see what exactly my brainwave pattern looks like at the moment I get some piece of data that's really direct, super cool, completely enlightening and answer something integral about what's at the target.
Yeah.
And so I have been able to use that biofeedback to train my own brainwave patterns. And so what I do now in remote viewing, and I was doing that during that tic-tac
awesome.
Exercise that I put online, I know what it feels like when you get real data. So I can put my brain in that state and operate from that. Now, this takes a while for somebody to learn, but anyone can do this.
Yeah, but if you are very physiologically aware of yourself, you know, it's no different than a good psychic hit on something, you know, or the idea of like learning to trust your gut and being like, yeah, so, I don't know, I don't need to go in that building. I need to go that way now. You know, no different than that, except now you actively have the Muse showing you that, no, something pulled the kite string behind your belly button. You should pay attention to that, you know.
That's exactly right.
After the cruise, I literally told Deborah Katz, because I have the older Muse headset and I have the newer one that also does blood pressure or heart rate, things like that. And I was like, I am going to, when I see my monitor in Hawaii this upcoming February, I'm going to give her my older one. And I want us to start doing like recording each other's brain waves while we're in session together to see if they sync up.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. And things that I now have brainwave pattern markers for over
awesome.
200 different items or activities. So if my brainwave pattern does a certain thing, I know without a shadow of a doubt
that is
there's
awesome.
A horse there. There is a horse.
Yeah.
It's an unmistakable pattern. And, you know, I have other patterns that I can recognize for different kinds of energetic events like bomb blasts or things that are racing fast. I have ones for ETs, ones for different kinds of people. It's super fascinating what I've been able to figure out. I'm actually going to be giving a lecture, free lecture on this. And
awesome.
You can find that on No rivets. It'll be in the first week of January.
Now, with that in mind, in our last few minutes, how many sessions of remote viewing have you done specifically with extraterrestrial as a target?
At least several thousand.
Wow.
Now, probably more than anybody else on the planet, and I say that sincerely.
Now, with that in mind, how many of those would you say generally have good to have you found different intent behind your sessions?
Yeah, it ranges wildly depending on what the target is.
Okay.
You know, if you're looking at some of the classic cases, the Roswell crash, for example, or the flyover Washington, 1952, there are a number of classic cases that I started with classic cases, and then I've gone on to some of the more esoteric type ET targets, and I've done like kind of civilization scans to find out where particular things may be, and even in our own galaxy. But they're all very different. I mean, we've been visited by a number of different kind of species throughout humanity. I mean, people have described over and over again the same kinds of creatures. We've got the short grays, we've got ones that are taller. You have, all different kinds, reptilian types, mantid types that people have been describing for eons. And they all seem to have different motivations, seem to come from a different place, seem to have a different way of communicating with you. If you are remote viewing, some of these things are telepathic and they know you're looking at them, and they'll send a message in return. And a lot of remote viewers have experienced that.
And I was going to ask that, you know, like specifically because that's always something that, whenever I talk astral projection, whenever I talk mediumship, and yes, even whenever I talk remote viewing, it's the idea of, is protection a consideration when you are doing a session? Because, as we've discussed with Lynn Buchanan, he's definitely been aware that other people are viewing his viewing session, that other people are in that viewing space with him, not necessarily like in the room with him, but they're in that mental room with him. They are in that adjunct dimension of space that he's viewing from, viewing him.
Absolutely. Sometimes you can sense other remote viewers. If you're looking, and these are you typically find that at some of these kind of classic targets, the atomic bomb blasts on the planet, you know, the Trinity site blaster, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, stuff like that. Chernobyl, another big one. You can oftentimes get the sense that there's other remote viewers there. And sometimes you get the sense that they sense you too. And with the ET type targets, if it's a highly telepathic species, oftentimes they'll just turn around and you get the sense they're looking right at you. They're reading right into you, and they may pass on a little message or not. And sometimes they may put up something to turn it off. You know, people may call it blocking. That can happen as well. So it's always interesting. I've never felt threatened by it.
Okay.
And never had any kind of bad experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doing this.
I just bring it up. I mean, you know, there's of course people like the good Dr. Stephen Greer who state publicly like none of these entities have ill will at heart. It's one of those I don't know. I mean, we may not consider it ill will in that kind of way, but we don't know what their motivation is.
I don't think that there is any particular species out there that's been interacting with us that wants to enslave us or kill us or take over the planet. I think that it's obvious that they would have by now
if
they were interested.
Yes.
But their motivations aren't the same as ours, and it can be very easy, even in remote viewing, to assign an anthropocentric view
to what
these guys are thinking. And sometimes you think after a session, I think, wow, that was a very strange experience, and I didn't quite like that being.
Yeah.
Because it's not that they're evil. It's just that perhaps their motivations aren't in alignment with my own.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, being distinctly aware of that is hugely important because, of course, you could also be remote influenced, you know, so knowing and having that extremely dedicated core of being that you are, Birdie, and that distinct knowledge of like, this is not who I am or what I'm about is hugely important, like massively important to avoid things like that. And that was one thing that I wanted to bring up, especially whenever you're viewing a traumatic site, a hugely historically traumatic site like the bomb blast of Nagasaki or Hiroshima, or like Pompeii. Things like that. Could it be the fact that you are not necessarily being viewed by remote viewers, but by those that are left behind, by those that have not moved into the light, so to speak? You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can feel that too. You can feel that too. Some places do have a kind of a ghostly presence. Civil War battlegrounds are really like that. If you're looking at Gettysburg, some of the other things like that. Yeah. And it can be overwhelming emotionally for some remote viewers. And I've had my own breakdowns during sessions, very emotional targets where I would be bawling because I would feel so strongly what had happened or someone's personal experience there. And I think that, you know, some people have the stomach for it and some people don't. So I try to figure out from my students what they're capable of when I'm teaching a class and choose things accordingly.
Yeah. And you know, even your wants and wishes accordingly, because as Lynn Buchanan has warned on the show, like you probably don't want to go find murdered and missing children. Like, that's not for everybody. Like, you think every cop wants to go out and be a detective. No, they don't. Some of them are perfectly good being a traffic cop because they don't want to go find a body a day.
Exactly. You know? Right. And that's why in my group, for our true crime group, those people have to opt into that. They have to say, I really want to do this. And they know that and some of them told me, I'm going to try it and see if I can handle it. And I'm like, okay, you can give it a try and see how you think. But it's not for everybody. And neither is looking at the ET phenomenon. That's not for everybody either. It can be very challenging to your own ideas about the world, your own ideas about spirituality or religion. And it can be difficult for people to wrap their minds around it if they haven't put a lot of thought into it.
It's a big one, Birdie. It's a big one. And it doesn't matter if you are a religious person or not. It is one of the triune questions of the world of who are we? Where do we come from? What else is there? You know, and that comes to life, death, and everything beyond or adjunct. You know, so yeah, it's a big question and a voluminous one, and one that can really change the stasis of your life hugely.
Yes.
And even remote viewing. I mean, I tell a lot of people, like, you know, it's you'd be surprised how it'll change the way you look at the world, how it will change the way you consider your connection to the world around you, and just how trivial three quarters of this crap is.
Exactly. It really puts life in its place, doesn't it?
It really does. And it puts you in your place as far as like, wow, well, that's pretty ego driven. You know,
I think
because
you learn more about yourself doing this than you learn about the rest of the universe.
Exactly. Because you really, once again, do learn that idea that Hal Puthoff put out there so long ago. How connected are we? Are we so connected that when we're at a distance and we think about something, can we influence it? You know,
the
idea of while I'm in traffic and I think, did I leave my iron on? Did I think it so long and so hard that my iron turned on and my apartment caught fire? You know, and it's pretty fascinating, but it's out there and it's a thing and it's a real thing. And science is coming closer and closer to actively just showing that and proving it, that right now we are sharing an atomic shell, Birdie, despite distance, but just being That's compressed right. by a quantum field into this body, you know?
Exactly.
But we're still tied together.
That's so right.
It's a beautiful thing. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a great conversation. That time absolutely flew by. You are more than welcome to come back anytime. Let everybody.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you. I really appreciate it. This was a fun conversation. Yeah, I enjoyed every
most
word.
Definitely.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to our good friend Carl McClellan for introducing us and making this happen. Big love to you, Carl.
Big love to Carl. I love him so much.
Same here. He's an amazing,
so
amazing individual. He witnessed a lot of pina coladas on the cruise. That's all I can say.
Well, I hope to join you guys next time.
Absolutely. Before we let you go, Birdie, let everybody know where they can follow you, where they can go to keep track of things, where they can go to register for their own classes of transdimensional mapping, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, you can see what I'm doing with remote viewing at norivets.com, norivets.com. And if you're interested in UFO stuff, my UFO group is abqufos.com, abqufos. And we have all kinds of cool events. Many are online, so you can join from anywhere in the world. And we do events in person here in Albuquerque, and we're putting on a big UFO conference next April called the Alien Explorations Conference. And we have
awesome
super top ufologists speaking, and I'll be speaking too on UFOs and remote viewing.
Fantastic. Birdie, thank you so much again for your time. It was so great, and I look forward to that conference. It looks like it'll be awesome.
It's going to be awesome. Thanks, Chris.
You bet. Absolutely. Please do hold the line while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, checking out everything from abqufos.com as well as norivets.com with Birdie, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all of our episodes and interviews. That's where you can find the videos page. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where we embed the YouTube channels of all of our guests like Birdie so that you can have access to them so easily right there, all in one spot, nice and easy to find. Thank you so much for your time tonight, everybody. It is your open hearts, your open minds that move the world, that make the world what it is. And without that, the conversation can't happen. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.